Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Hari Kunzru, whose latest novel is Gods Without Men. Earlier novels, The Impressionist, Transmission, My Revolutions. Hari Kunzru has been a TV interviewer, music editor, contributing editor at Moat magazine, travel journalist, worked at Wire in the 90s, and now also writes for The Guardian UK. Gods Without Men is similar in style to certain kinds of books in which short stories combine to create a novel. I'm thinking specifically, of course, Cloud Atlas, but also A Visit from the Goon Squad. It seems to be the latest in trying to find new ways to tell a story. But then in looking over your other work, actually all of your books have multiple stories that combine. So this book is less something different than just a continuation of the work you've done before. Is that pretty much right?
Yeah, I'd say I've always had an interest in kind of running several things in parallel, so to speak. And I think you're right to say that there are several writers who are trying to explore new ways of structuring a piece of fiction, because I think conventional plotting has now become such a sort of kind of mechanical art, almost. If you think about screenwriting, people are taught when to put a moment of reversal for the central character. You know, we have an intuitive sense almost now. We've learned so much about plot in the last 200-300 years as a culture that there's certain kinds of closure that have a glib quality, that don't really function anymore. And you're finding more and more writers who actually want to kind of break open that kind of perfect clockwork, nicely finished, nicely tied up kind of plot and try and kind of let some light and air in. And one of the ways of doing that is to run things side by side and kind of let them resonate or rhyme or, you know, interact with each other in ways that aren't completely rational almost.
As we were talking, I realized that this has been going on in film for a while. Traffic, Babel, and maybe the first in this series is now considered kind of a postmodern classic, which is Pulp Fiction.
I think I'd want to say that what I'm doing is fundamentally opposed to some of those, especially those kind of Mexican multi-stranded movies. I mean, and I think, you know, this has in some ways been mistaken for that kind of work. But what I don't like is the idea that human lives are connected by these little moments of connection and epiphanies, these kind of quasi-religious kind of interactions that structure it and give it meaning. That's not what I'm interested in. My kind of gaps are gaps for the reader to fall into and demand a kind of work from the reader to fit together. I'm not so interested in producing a kind of tapestry of coincidence that kind of leads towards the sense that, hey, it's all connected and maybe there's this deep meaning, this profound meaning behind our everyday lives. I want to say something that's a little more troubling and maybe a little more complex than that.
Which is?
That as human beings, we are always in relationship to the unknown and sometimes to what's fundamentally unknowable. In a way, that's what it's the primary kind of moral, ethical way of consideration that we have to make in our lives, is how you deal with the unknown. I mean, obviously, one solution for dealing with that is to say what's beyond my comprehension belongs to God. If, however, like me, you don't have a belief in a kind of personalized creator God to whom you owe an ethical duty, that doesn't really let you off the hook in terms of these questions about meaning and value and human agency and, you know, what's the right way to live your life. All that stuff is still in play, but you have to find something that's not a kind of one word solution for it. You know, I mean, my sense of things is that a kind of active interpretation, a kind of way of living that doesn't close off questions, that kind of keeps on a kind of alertness to the complexity of life, that doesn't kind of collapse things down onto simple answers, is a very important thing. I mean, this is a book about faith in a way, and there are lots of people who are out in the desert, lots of different characters who are out in the desert, and they're looking for some kind of answers about their lives. And the structure of their searching is what I'm hoping to bring out by telling various parallel stories. I mean, the earliest action in this book is in the 18th century, and But the spine of the story is a present-day story about a couple with an autistic child, a four-year-old child who disappears out in the desert. And they're forced to confront the question of the unknown through the very sort of scary and immediate thing of their kid disappearing. But their kind of searching for their missing child becomes parallel to other sorts of sort of spiritual searching that people like a Franciscan friar who's exploring in the 18th century, a Mormon silver miner, lapsed Mormon silver miner who's kind of dying of mercury poisoning, an anthropologist, a kind of cult leader. It's the structure that interests me rather than the answer. Because I think the answer can be framed in lots of different language. For one of these guys, it's UFOs. For another, it's a Catholic notion of God. But what's universal is this having to negotiate these ethical, moral questions and having to negotiate with the unknown.
As I was reading the book and afterward thinking about it and taking my notes, it dawned on me that, in a sense, what you're doing is pretty much showing the nature of the grasp for spirituality. I found this in dreams or any time I get a psychic impulse and I'm going, wow, I'm almost there. There's a door that just needs to open and I'll know it, but that door never opens.
And that's a sense that I really got traveling out in the high desert. And I've been there a lot over the last 2-3 years. And I think the driving impulse behind needing to write a book about the place is exactly this feeling you're describing. I mean, when you're out on your own in this, you know, this place with the kind of white land and hard white light striking the land, the kind of the dazzle is almost so much, you know, midday and summer's day, the colors get bleached out. You know, it's the contrast goes down. You're in a world where the difference between earth and sky seems very tenuous. I always get this feeling that if I could only see round corners, if I could only see the thing that's being hidden by the bright sunlight, and everything is so clear and so visible, and there's nothing for nowhere for anything to hide. But somehow, in that very clarity, is something otherworldly, and you really understand why the desert has, throughout history, been a kind of place of religious visions, and it's been a place that people have gone to in order to kind of try and access their spirituality. So, but it is this feeling of almost grasping something, if not quite being able to pin down what it is.
And I wonder also if there is an actual explanation. And your character of Jazz seems to be working with a computer program called Walter, which is trying to find that explanation, at least in terms of economics. The explanation will probably wind up being disappointing. I kept thinking, you know, if he answers the questions here, this becomes a science fiction novel.
Well, I'm very interested in science fiction because it's a kind of mode that allows people to pose these big kind of, you know, high concept ideas. I mean, Jazz is the husband in this couple, and Jazz and his wife, Lisa, and Jazz is a scientifically trained guy. He has a higher degree in physics, and he ends up working on Wall Street as a financial analyst, using his same kind of physical modeling techniques to model the economy. And his boss, an eccentric man, has devised this computer model, it's a trading engine. They're intending to use it to trade in various markets. But there's something about this engine that seems to be accessing kind of very profound patterns and you know, this sense of meaning almost grasped. The thing is picking out patterns in various markets that you wouldn't have thought possible, the oscillations that the connections between different sets of figures, different kind of wildly disconnected asset classes that surely can't be influencing each other. And the hint appears to be that they're onto some kind of very profound structuring principle about the world. And the whole business of the markets and meaning and so on is interesting to me because, of course, the markets are, money is built on faith. I mean, think of the root of the word credit, credo, I believe. You know, things are worth what they're worth because we all consent to believe that they're worth that much. When our sense of belief fails, what happens? We get a crash. And so the kind of New York world of this financial services and so on is actually much closer to the spiritual questing in the desert than would first be apparent. But also there's the question of, is it actually possible to make the model that will have produced these answers, that will have this kind of final set of answers. And mathematically, a lot of people will say that, no, it's not possible. You think of something like Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which shows that there are true propositions in mathematical systems that can't be proved by the system. There's always some bleed. There's always something that's outside the scope.
And there's also entropy as well.
And there is also entropy. That interests me very much. You know, if time is simply a measure of randomness and increasing decay.
I kept thinking also with Walter that in essence, Walter serves as a metaphor for the entire book, Gods Without Men.
What are you doing as a novelist? You're making a model and you're winding it up and you're trying to see if it kind of matches experience. And if your book is a good book, then you can trade on your model.
How conscious for you were these ideas when you were working on the book?
I don't like the idea of making a piece of fiction where all the characters are just carrying around these kind of backpacks full of concepts that the writer wants them to hump about. But I am interested in character in writing novels because I think a novel is a really, really good way of exploring some of the kind of complex network phenomena in the world that we live in. I often make the case for novels as opposed to films as being the kind of narrative of art that can really tell us about the world now, because the novel does complexity very well. You know, think about it, novelists can show interiority and exteriority, and novelists can kind of move out from the very sort of intimate personal scale into describing large social phenomena, you know, massive events, and the ease with which you can do that and the ways in which you can kind of make comparisons are just not available to a filmmaker, however large the budget.
Oh, well, filmmaker is stuck with the documentary, what you're seeing.
The filmmaker is stuck with the exterior. You know, if you want to show something happening to somebody in a film, you need to show it in an exterior way. The guy is unhappy, he has to cry, or he has to look out of the window in a meaningful way with the, you know, the minor key music.
The ultimate question for, I guess, a filmmaker would be, how do you show an unreliable narrator? And the answer is you don't.
Absolutely. That was a problem I came up against when talking to directors about a possible film of my first novel, which is all about somebody who is seen in different ways by different people. This character is a young guy in 1920s India who's an Indian guy, but he's pretending to be a white Englishman. And the interest in the narrative is that, exactly as you're saying, this kind of unreliability, destabilized perception. But the kind of objective eye of a camera, how do you get to that? How do you get to the fact that one person's seeing him in one way and another in another?
Harry Kunz-Ru, in an interview in Publishers Weekly, you talk about that much of the novel Gods Without Men deals with absence, particularly the absence of communication, most obviously in the character of Raj, the autistic Asperger's, whatever you want to call it, child of Jazz and Lisa, but it also runs through Transmission, which is all about communication. And in your own career, working in these different areas, particularly the area of Wired, in which, you know, the internet is all communication, yet at the same time, as we all know, no communication.
Mm. In Transmission was a novel that was structured around this idea of signal and noise, you know, this kind of very engineer's notion of information theory, you know, the idea being that in a kind of classical sense, engineers are trying to work out how you can send a signal from a sender to a receiver without that signal degrading, the message you're sending getting through without any noise. And the idea of a perfect transmission, a completely pure transmission from sender to receiver, is an ideal that doesn't exist in reality. And then, of course, you know, you extend that out from the nuts and bolts of sending a signal down a wire to the idea of interpersonal communication and you're into all the sort of profound business about how it's possible to have community with other people and how it's possible for us to function in a world where our desires and our messages and our wish to communicate will never be absolutely fulfilled. And it was interesting to me to come to that from a kind of technical point of view, which is probably not the first line of attack that most novelists would take. Because, I have through my career worked a lot as a technology journalist and as a sort of observer of the ways that technology impacts culture. And I think, you know, I've always been profoundly excited by technology and the ways that it is transforming society. You know, in my 20s, I ended up working, you know, having this kind of ringside seat for the birth of the internet as a mass phenomenon. I remember being the guy who was showing all sorts of friends this thing, the internet, for the first time, and, you know, and people saying to me, well, you know, it'll never catch on, and me trying to say, well, you know, this really is going to change everything. And then, you know, here we are from kind of 15 years later, and it has wrought this transformation on us, you know, in good ways and bad.
There are several sections in the book about, well, it's a UFO commune that kind of turns into a hippie commune, in which they're trying to communicate with UFOs. And in essence, that parallels how we're trying to communicate with each other. And of course, the responses, how many times have you sent out an email? It bounces back. Or worse than that, you send out a message, and because there's no inflection in the message, the person completely misinterprets you.
Yeah, it's noise in your signal. The UFO thing became more and more obvious that it had to be a central part of any novel about the high desert, because, you know, really it was in the Mojave that the whole modern UFO mythology was born, and it was born out of this very interesting confluence of technology and spirituality. You know, there is a pre-existing sort of spiritualist tradition which goes at least as far back as kind of people like Madame Blavatsky and the Golden Dawn in the late 19th century, about these ascended masters, these higher beings, you know, which they tend to include figures like Jesus and the Buddha in a kind of pantheon of sort of global monitors who are many of whom have kind of sprung fully formed out of their own writings. But the idea is that this pantheon of ascended masters are looking down on us and are hoping to help us through our troubles. And then after the incredibly sort of traumatic moment of the end of the Second World War and the dropping of the atomic bomb, it became apparent to everybody that there was, maybe for the first time, the possibility humanity had in its hands the means of its own destruction and the destruction of the planet. And here was a place where there were a lot of religiously inclined people, and here was a place where there was a lot of aerospace testing, and there was a lot of secret aerospace testing of one kind or another. You know, as the Cold War got going, it was the deserts of the Western United States where America was testing new weapon systems of various kinds. And the bright lights in the sky and the feeling that something traumatic was possibly going to befall the Earth, and the possibility that there would be higher beings who would come and help us out, rolled up into the first wave of UFO sightings, which fascinatingly almost always involved these higher beings, these human, often they're described as Nordic aliens. There's a lot of, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes and Grecian style attire going on. And, you know, they invariably come down and say, you know, we've come to help you heal the binary opposition of the Cold War. We've come to help you deal with your new technological power. And it was only later on, as things changed, you know, as the security state generated by the Cold War became something that was apparent in people's lives, and people kind of became accustomed to the notion that the government had ballooned into this entity where there was unaccountable kind of dark doings and whole kind of large technologically driven programs that weren't visible to the public, then the notion of sort of secrecy and paranoia comes in, and you start getting these other kind of alien contacts. That's when the, you know, things like the late 50s, when people first start to describe abductions and kind of probings and all these kind of much more hostile experiences with the aliens we become very familiar with. And the new aliens are the aliens that we're now familiar with in the X-Files and E.T., you know, the greys, these almond-eyed kind of, you know, humanoid but not human-looking beings who are much more hostile and often treat us in our encounters with them like cattle. So there are these feelings about what the other might be like, what the unknown might be like. Is it hostile and threatening? Is it a transcendent moment of joy? And this is all getting wrapped up in the figure of the possible encounter with the other. Is it going to be this moment of spiritual wholeness, or is it going to be a new terror?
Harry Kunz-Ruh, one of the things the internet has done is it's created a confluence of conspiracy theories. you know, there was the Catholic conspiracy theory with the two popes. There was the conspiracy that Jesus is alive. There was the UFO conspiracy, the Nordics versus the Greys. There were all of these. And what you have now, because of the internet, is the mingling of conspiracies. It's like they could all get together and be paranoid as one.
Absolutely. It becomes a way of you really kind of getting a feel for the structure of conspiracy. You know, I mean, why is conspiracy always, almost always a kind of failure to actually acknowledge the complexity of things? Like, you know, I'm always fascinated by the, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theories that go around, that all these sort of thousands of people in the federal government, you know, are supposed to have been complicit in this terrible plot to bring down the Twin Towers and then cause this new level of the security state to come into being. You know, and this is a country where you can barely sleep with someone in a motel, you know, without the Drudge Report having it, you know, the next morning. And the idea that somehow this kind of watertight conspiracy involving many thousands. But the conspiracy theory is the wish to believe in a kind of understandable agency. Complexity is going to collapse down onto a simple plan.
And you'll get your answer.
Right, and you will get your answer. The Jews are behind the lot, whatever that kind of hokey answer is supposed to be. You know, I think what I'm kind of trying to say with my remarks about the structure of the novel is it's the same thing. It's trying not to collapse complexity down onto simplicity, to kind of keep certain things open and to allow resonances and rhymes and echoes to happen without kind of crunching them all together and saying, ta-da, it's the aliens.
That goes back to the idea that a book is 50% the writer and 50% the reader. You're going to draw your own conclusions, and you should.
Absolutely. You know, we know that intellectually, but when you write, it's very interesting to become aware of the fact that, you know, you're in a collaborative process of making meaning with your reader, and you don't know who your reader is going to be. You get reviewed sometimes and people say, well, clearly it was a satirical demolishing of X. And then somebody else say, well, he's clearly in love with X. And he's advocating for X. And, you know, you realize there's much more slippage and much more noise in the signal than you're giving credit for.
It's the noise that you're trying to create as well.
The noise that you're trying to listen to. I think that's what's interesting to a lot of writers at the moment. You know, we can do classical plots. We can kind of make books where the answer appears at the end in the way that it would in a whodunit, in a thriller or whatever, or the couple gets together in the end and are happily ever after as it would be in a romance. But, you know, if you're going to try and make something that isn't merely a kind of comforting entertainment and isn't merely a kind of nicely shaped thing with a closure in the end, then you are dealing with noise and you are dealing with complexity that doesn't kind of collapse down onto something simple.
Did you actually see the three pinnacles when you were in the desert?
Well, the pinnacles don't exist. A lot of people have assumed that I mean the Trona pinnacles, which is a series of many, many kind of tufa, it's called. There's a kind of a spire-like rock structure, which is kind of quite near Edwards Air Force Base. In terms of the location, I was thinking of a place which is where there's a boulder. There's a place called Giant Rock out in a place north of Joshua Tree. It's called Landers, which was the world's largest freestanding boulder. And under that boulder in the 1940s, there was a guy called George Van Tassel who was contacting Venus and became one of the most famous of the first generation of UFO contactees. So I replaced the boulder with a kind of symbol of a trinity, which, of course, you know, if you have Christian inclinations, that's a highly symbolic thing. And, you know, and I wanted a natural formation which would almost kind of invite interpretation and invite kind of overdetermined meanings. And so I've kind of made some stuff up.
Harry Kunzru, you also do a lot of research in all of your books to get a sense of what the 60s was like, the 70s, the 20s, and even 1947. You have a character whose last name is Capaldi, which wasn't that one of the members of Traffic?
That's possibly true. I don't know. I mean, this kind of thing's happening to me all the time. I mean, he's a Londoner. He's like, I can't remember, were Traffic from London? Or they were from the southeast somewhere, weren't they?
There's also a segment about a fake Iraqi town in the desert. Is that based on anything real?
Amusingly, one or two critics in the UK pointed to this as an example of where I'd really jumped the shark, and you know, this was broad satire of a sort that was inappropriate. But It's almost the most documentary part of the entire book for many years, just since, you know, since the at least the kind of early 2000s. The Marines have been training troops who are going to be sent to Iraq and Afghanistan by performing massive simulations, like these giant role-playing games where they have these simulated villages on Marine bases, notably in the 29 Palms Marine Base and in the Mojave. Hired Arab Americans to play the villages. The structures are kind of shipping containers, which are all faced with kind of realistic looking kind of brick and stonework provided by Hollywood set design companies. The Iraqis are given characters. There's a kind of measuring systems. You know, the troops are supposed to be kind of managing their district, and you know, things will happen, like there'll be insurgent attacks and there'll be problems of various kinds, and they'll have to win hearts and minds, and it's absurd on one level, and there's a sort of pathos to it, because I mean, you see these you know, I've seen some film of troops trying to negotiate this, and you know, they're kind of walking around saying salam alaikum, and you know, they don't really know what to do beyond that to kind of be nice to these people. And the oddity of being an Iraqi, playing an Iraqi in another desert, the overlaying of one desert into the other really interested me. Because, I mean, you know, the desert has been part of the American imagination for the last decade. The Iraqi desert has been. We've seen so much imagery of there, and so much of the destiny of this country has become wrapped up with that faraway desert. And the idea that that's being kind of overlaid onto the Mojave, yet another use for this supposedly empty place, is really interesting to me.
We talked a little bit before about the title of the book, and I understand that the title wasn't originally Gods Without Men.
The book wasn't called Gods Without Men until very, very late. The Balzac quote is from a story called Passion in the Desert. An old soldier, a Napoleonic soldier who has served in Napoleon's campaign in Egypt, asks, what is the desert? And he, you know, he says, it's everything and nothing. It's God without man. And that chime very precisely with my kind of sense of the desert as a metaphysical space, and as a sort of space that somehow is terrifyingly self-contained and doesn't need us. It's the feeling when you're out in the middle of this place, you have a feeling of being kind of quite vulnerable and quite superfluous to the larger doings of the cosmos. And it's that feeling that quote, I can't remember when I found it. You know, early on, I was trying to find any material about deserts, and especially kind of meditative things about deserts. I was going to call the book The Pinnacles, and then I was going to call it Coyote, and then Gods Without Men seemed like a better title.
I understand you were listening to a mixtape when you were writing Gods Without Men.
I listen to music when I'm working, and I kind of tend to collect music that in some way speaks to me. You know, I'll have a kind of file of stuff that speaks to me about the material in the book, and I thought it would be fun to just to make a listing. It's kind of, you know, I did a posting with a bunch of YouTube links, and somebody else has made it into a Spotify, so if you use that, there's a bunch of kind of psychedelic classics, kind of things like kind of 13th Floor Elevators, and some sort of Harry Smith's anthology kind of 20s 30s folk music, and a lot of the kind of minimalist music that I tend to listen to when I'm actually writing, as kind of minimalist and ambient things, as a way of, this is sort of aid concentration. Kind of more than silence does for me, I tend to work with headphones on. I live and work in a very tiny New York studio with my fiance, who's also a novelist, and we're kind of sitting at two desks, kind of facing away from each other. So you have to kind of create privacy and create a kind of an office for yourself virtually.
You made a comment a second ago that critics said that it's kind of inappropriate satire. Where do critics come off saying that anything in a novel is inappropriate?
I mean, you hear an awful lot of stuff as a writer when you put something out into the public domain. Everybody gets to have an opinion. That's how it works. But, I mean, I'm interested in the notion of what's appropriate and what's not, because people will pronounce on that quite confidently, and one person's notion of what's appropriate then clearly differs almost completely from the next. So, you know, it's another more noise in the signal.
Harry Kunzru, let's go back a little bit to your career. The first thing you worked on was Wired. Was that right after you got out of college?
It wasn't. I had a rather sort of checkered few years. I mean, I did an undergraduate degree in English literature, very, very traditional, kind of canonical, reading the great works kind of degree. And I came out of that wanting to be a novelist. And I did what you could do at that moment in England, which is I went on the dole and I took odd jobs. I worked in various kind of, I worked as a driver. I had a brief picturesque moment as a juggler, handing out promotional soft drinks in nightclubs. And I worked in restaurants and bars and yada yada. And after a couple of years, they had a very, to my mind, very bad Pynchon-influenced manuscript and a realization that I probably needed to try and find something else to do with myself. I ended up going back to school to study philosophy. I got a master's degree in philosophy and then came out of that realizing I did not want to be a professional philosopher, that the whole idea of a professional philosopher seemed to me like something of a kind of absurdity.
I got a master's in philosophy and thought the same thing. Came west instead.
Right. There's nothing like a kind of philosophy department for giving you a taste for some real world life, the texture of some actual living. But as almost as a kind of side effect, well, I was supposed to be studying philosophy and literature and thinking a lot about kind of continental philosophers like Heidegger and how that would work with poetry. And actually, I was spending all my time down the hall with the AI crowd and a bunch of people who were fooling around. This is 92 with the net. And so I got sort of blindsided by the realization that there was something, the philosophy associated with Gilles Deleuze actually was getting kind of mapped onto all this stuff about technology. I kind of came out of that, and somebody gave me an introduction to a guy who was starting the UK edition of Wired, and I wangled my way into a job. At that point there weren't so many people who could write a sentence and give a sort of plausible explanation of an IP stack. And that turned out to be my most marketable skill for several years. So I was this kind of accidental technology journalist, sort of dreaming of being a novelist.
Well, you also wrote music criticism as well.
Well, I've always taken the view that you should try and monetize your interests where it's all possible, and I like free stuff. So the idea of getting sent music to have an opinion about was my dream job.
And what happened to that early manuscript?
It's still on my hard drive. I don't think I've even opened the file for a while. I mean, there are two unpublished novels, and they're bad in opposite ways, I think. And they were kind of necessary for me to write, to learn what I was actually doing, to learn my craft. So I sort of don't regret it now, but at the time it was painful to realize that, I wasn't the kind of 21-year-old uber genius I hoped I was.
And how did the Impressionists come about? Suddenly you were trying again?
Basically having had these two kind of stillborn creatures, and the thing I'd worked out was very much to do with pleasure and with the pleasure of writing and the pleasure of reading. And I kind of made a rule that if I was going to try again, I was going to do something that gave me great pleasure to write and was aimed at entertaining the reader while, And so this was how I went into The Impressionist, which is a kind of big baggy monster of a novel with all sorts of slapstick stuff going on. It's a big picaresque comic novel, and it was very enjoyable to write and research, and was kind of, it's got gags in it, it's supposed to be a funny book. And and oddly that turned out to be the one that got published, and sort of set me up for a chance to have a career as a writer.
You mentioned before you like science fiction. Did you read a lot of science fiction as a kid?
Well, actually, my parents at one point, they confessed to me recently that they went for a meeting with my teacher at school to discuss the fact that aged about 13, I was reading nothing but science fiction and fantasy, and was this okay? Should they be attempting to force me to read Little Women or something? And the teacher very sensibly said, he's reading, it's a good thing, he'll read what he wants to read, and eventually he'll read some other stuff. And after a while I began to get frustrated with the ways in which which genre science fiction novels often fail. You know, that's often around character and and certain sorts of other things. But I've retained an immense fondness for that kind of writing, and actually, now I'm finding myself kind of coming back to some of those books and trying to see, what holds up and what doesn't.
Well, which books?
One writer who I was obsessed by at the 12-13 was a British fantasy writer called Michael Moorcock.
Oh, sure, I interviewed him years ago.
Right, and Mike lives out in near Austin now. In fact, I'm going to be visiting him in a week or two. I finally, as an adult Guardian writer, pitched an interview with him and went out to meet him last year. But and his, funnily enough, his sort of he writes a lot of very, as you know, as these kind of picaresque fantasy stories, and he has a great kind of inheritance from the sort of British psychedelia of the late 60s, and he was my conduit into a lot of things that like J.G. Ballard, like certain sorts of, postmodernism, even kind of, the music of the 60s, various things which have become, pleasures of mine now.
Do you miss the fact that you were too young for the 60s?
I had to write a whole book to deal with that, to my bad case of era envy. And I wrote a novel called My Revolutions, and which is about a leftist radical in London in the late 60s, early 70s, who gradually makes the decision to turn to violence. And I grew up, my generation got nicknamed Thatcher's children. I was 9 years old when Mrs. Thatcher came into power, and I was in my mid-20s when she left, and when the Tory government left. And my experience of being young was that nothing was going to change. That and I was always very jealous of the idea that you could be young at a moment when you thought that your generation was about to wreak this complete transformation on the world. And I wanted to find out really, truly, what was a kind of self-serving about that narrative. Because, my lot were always getting beaten around the head by the old 60s characters, kind of saying, well, why aren't you more active? Why aren't you making a revolution? Why aren't you doing this? We did that. We had such a great time. Our drugs were stronger. Our music was better. And, eventually what we had was that we had the rave era in that's what my generation eventually did, which was our kind of version of the had many of the same dreams of kind of communal living, social transformation, a kind of cosmic exploration through music and drugs, all this kind of stuff. And I think ultimately we held our own, but I did want in a very serious way to kind of go back and kind of sift through the kind of wrecked dreams of the new left and of the 60s counterculture, which had become so unfashionable and become, people will dismiss them in such a sort of offhand way as embarrassing. And I think there's a road not traveled down there. There's a sense of possibility and a sense of that people can build their own lives and are able to kind of transform their own lives, that I think we do well to get back to. And perhaps through things like Occupy and other social movements at the moment, some of the legacy of that time is being rediscovered.
Well, hopefully a lot of those weekend hippies did become Republicans. Gods Without Men, Harry Kunzru, the title, apparently, according to an interview, comes from two different ideas. One is that without worshippers, gods disappear,
which is the ancient Greek and Roman notion.
And also from Balzac?
Yeah, and he wrote a story called Passion in the Desert, where it's an old soldier who's been who was part of Napoleon's campaign in Egypt, is asked, what is the desert? And he answers that it's God without man. It's everything and nothing. It's God without man. And that kind of gets to something that I wanted to say about this, the desert as a metaphysical space and as a space of sort of spiritual yearning and as a space which kind of seems to exist independently of being observed by people. It's very self-contained. It's very absolute. and the kind of the ways that as people we come out of the cities into this empty space, this hostile, barren landscape, and deal with ourselves in that landscape. You know, that's the kind of movement I wanted to describe in this book.
Well, you do have a political activist side, which I want to get to in a second. How do you think that side, this is the side that turned down an award because it came from the Sunday Mail. This is the side that went to Jaipur, is it? Went to Jaipur and read sections of satanic verses, which are illegal to read in India. How do you think that side of Hari Kunzru relates to Gods Without Men?
Well, I mean, we want to draw the distinction between stuff you can do in a novel and stuff you shouldn't be doing in a novel. And I think that if you're writing a novel in order to sell a position or a point of view, the chances are you're going to write a bad novel, because the skill of the novelist is surely to kind of open spaces and to keep sympathies open, to kind of to set up situations which political and ethical, moral questions can rise up in, but without kind of closing them down and saying, "Hey, reader, you need to feel this about this person, and you need to kind of believe this about what's possible to do in society." You know, I have my opinions about political issues, and unlike some other novelists, I don't see a problem with kind of expressing those in public, but. I am interested in questions of social justice. I am interested in questions of inequality. You know, I think my background as a mixed race kid growing up in the UK brought me really ground my nose in a lot of political questions that maybe as an otherwise kind of middle class suburban kid I could have avoided. You know, in my life I felt that politics wasn't really optional. It was something that happened to me rather than me choosing to kind of take it up. But, and I like the idea of an engaged novel. But what I mean by that isn't a novel that serves a particular program. You know, it's not Ayn Rand or socialist realism. You know, it's a novel that kind of puts the big questions of our time in play. I think, you know, what else, you know, what, you know, you've got a space to tell a story, and we're living lives that are touched by, you know, and buffeted around by major social forces, technological forces, cultural forces, and, you know, writers should be tackling this stuff.
Well, it comes in the back door in the questions about identity that both Jazz and Lisa have. Jazz as an Americanized, he's from Kashmir.
He's Punjabi. He's
Punjabi.
He's a Punjabi Sikh.
He's a Punjabi Sikh, not what you are.
No. I mean, my father's side of my family, Kashmiri Pundits, and my mother's side are English, Church of England, kind of Episcopalians.
So the moment that that Jazz walks around without a turban, he's pretty much given the finger to his past.
Absolutely. You know, he makes the decision to cut his hair and to stop wearing the kind of symbols of his faith, and which is a huge disappointment to his family. You know, and this is a question that immigrant families face again and again in one form or another. What do you keep and what do you jettison? When you're bringing up American kids or you're bringing up British kids, what is it? What's okay for them to kind of take from the environment where they live, and what should you sort of struggle to make them hold on to from the place where you came from as parents?
And Lisa and Jazz have another issue, which is their son, which rarely do you see a couple so torn over living life with a son who's disabled and feeling guilty about it.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to this question of disability is really, this is a personal one to me, is really sort of important, because in a very different way, it's in a couple of places it's touched my extended family, and I've seen that even in, you know, modern educated, broadly secular families, there's a huge guilt that kind of comes with having a disabled child, and there's a huge sort of emotional pressure on the parents, and it can be very, very destructive. And recently there's been a spate of cute savant-like Asperger's kids in fiction and film, and you know they're you know, it's all sort of Rain Man, and they're kind of amazing because they've got this wonderful Martian way of viewing the world, blah blah blah. I wanted to make a child who's hopefully a reasonably accurate depiction of what it might actually be like to live with a very, very seriously autistic child. He's nonverbal, he's incontinent, he has terrors that aren't kind of easily soothable by his mother. He doesn't like to be touched. It's a kind of extreme situation for a parent to attempt to love and care for a child that seems oblivious or actively kind of to be rejecting of your care. There's the kind of cultural issues as well around disability. You know, in South Asian cultures, there is a lot of social stigma about disability. You know, it's something that isn't dealt with in a very good way. Often there's and here is a mixed marriage, and Jazz and Lisa's from this secularized Jewish background. You know, she and Jazz have got together. They've kind of overcome, they think, the differences between their backgrounds, and yet, from Jazz's family's point of view, and you know, they come from a village background. You know, they're sort of straight out of the villages of northwestern India. From their point of view, well, this is what you get. You know, you marry outside the community, you marry outside your caste, and this kind of thing will happen. It's a taint of blood, and it. There's also a lot of stuff about the evil eye and so on that he's having to deal with, and which is incredibly disturbing and offensive to his wife.
Did you growing up get some of that kind of cultural, I don't know what you call it, dissonance with the actual life you were living in England?
There's a complexity to it, and it's usually a complexity that's imposed from outside rather than one that exists within your family. I mean, my parents' marriage was a problem for my father's family initially, and you know, for the first couple of years, they weren't on speaking terms with my father's family back in India, but they were in the UK, they were in London, and it was easier for my mum's family because they're actually meeting my dad and they're seeing that, you know, he's good to their daughter. You know, he's a nice guy, he's very charming, my dad. You know, he won them over. But, you know, for me growing up, I had this situation where there's this big extended family in India who I'd see maybe once every year or two, you know, in a sort of family visit, and living in quite a traditional way. When I was a small kid, it was in this big, my grandparents were still alive, and they're in this big old manor house in Agra, which had got no running hot water. The hot water would be heated by the servants in the servants' quarters downstairs, and there would be, it was almost like a way of life that had a lot to do with a lot of continuity with the 19th century, you know, and the very idea of a little boy my age bringing a bucket of hot water for me to have a wash in was just mortifying for me, and was very difficult to kind of, you know, another way I suppose political questions kind of thrust themselves upon me without needing to. But the sort of off the point, the dissonance between that world, the world of a kind of traditional Indian household, and the kind of late 70s, early 80s suburbs of London was a huge dissonance, and it wasn't understood by any of the people around me. And, you know, trying to kind of encompass that, and it always comes down to this question, you know, where are you from? Now, somebody, people would see a little brown-skinned kid, and they, you know, did say, "Where are you from?" And I would grit my teeth and I would say Woodford, which was the name of the suburb. But, you know, I'd force them to say what they actually meant, which was, you know, who had sex to make you. And, you know, and it's intrusive. That kind of question, in a way, it feels very sort of, it feels like it's a tough question for a kid, because it's as if you've got to justify yourself and you've got to account for your being there. You know, there was this, you know, one of the many things I found it tough to forgive the government of the moment for was this, you know, this famous speech about the cricket test. Which was given by a government minister called Norman Tebbit, this kind of a character whose nickname was the Chingford Skinhead. He was a nasty piece of work, and he, you know, he basically said, you know, you've got a choice. You either cheer for the team of the country that you came from, or you cheer for the English team. And if you cheer for England, then you can stay, and if you cheer for the other lot, you should go. And this kind of, the crudeness of that, the notion that in order to justify your right to be in the UK, that you had in some way to jettison any emotional attachment or any feelings towards the, you know, the country, you know, from which, you know, your family came from was, you know, it puts a real pressure on you, especially as a little kid. I'd grown up in England, you know, people saying, "Packy, go home." We were like, "Well, I'm, you know, I'm about 10 minutes from my house. You know, what am I going to do? This is home. I've got to live with you lot." And, you know, so those kind of things were all around. And I think that worldview, that kind of being forced to embrace complexity and a certain amount of dealing with complexity that was being forced upon me by other people, that's all there in the writing now. You know, that's the basis of why I became a writer, I think.
You have an interesting gay couple, a younger man, and then a very elderly partner who he's taking care of. And that's, I think, one of the first times I've actually seen that. It's kind of the Isherwood idea, you know, in a novel. What prompted you to put that in there?
I've met one or two couples like that, and I've actually been rather moved by the, you know, the care that a younger partner was showing to an older one. But also, I mean, this is Jazz's boss. You know, Jazz is working for this Wall Street firm, and he doesn't even really think to ask about his boss's private life. He just assumes he hasn't really got one. And then, you know, they're invited out to the Hamptons, to the weekend place, and then he sort of discovers that, you know, his boss has an emotional life that's textured and complex, and you know, he knew nothing about, and he's very thrown by this, and he's also thrown by the fact that his wife Lisa just is charmed by these two. They're sophisticated. They collect books and talk about music and art and a lot of things that he feels that don't really belong to him and that he can't compete with, and so he kind of ends up having very negative, bitter reaction.
Well, he's a very angry guy.
He is. He's got a huge chip on his shoulder. But it's kind of, in many ways, the strain of trying to kind of keep his family in his life while leading, you know, while having kind of transformed himself so in a way that's so far from their expectations is, you know, he's under a lot of pressure, and he's a very unresolved character.
I think it's an example when he shows up at the house of how, I guess, you know, when people talk about a character taking over, that you can kind of sit back, and because you know Jazz so well, you can make determinations, or Jazz almost makes the determinations as to how he's going to respond.
Yeah, I mean, once you've got that situation, everybody can just do their thing in a scene like that, and it, you know, and it'll become the tensions are just built in. Yeah, I mean, that's one situation when you know you're working well because the stuff is coming up without you having to kind of force it along.
Harry Kunzru, did you have any problems figuring out how it was going to end, how the book was going to end?
I think I knew from quite early on that the end moment would be a vision that contained nothing. That of, you know, something that was shaped like a great spiritual revelation but was sort of devoid of content. And I don't think it's giving anything really away to say that. But I also, Later I realized that I wanted to end with a kind of with something that was actually would kind of jolt back. The very very end of the novel is actually a section about the 18th century Spanish friar who's actually a character who really existed, but I've made one fictional intervention in his life. This is a character called Fray Garcés, who was the head of the mission at San Javier del Bac in, you know, what's present day Tucson, and he walked across the Colorado River and walked on his own across the Mojave, carrying nothing but a cross and an oil painting, with on one side a picture of the Virgin and a child, and on the other side a picture of a sinner damned to hell. And using this handy visual aid, he attempted to convert the native people that he found there. And an extraordinary, extraordinary project. And I made this intervention that in his diary, which was a document that he kept, that there's a missing period, and into that missing period I put a spiritual revelation, and so that's what I end the book with, but that's doubled with another kind of another vision for Jazz and Lisa, and so kind of the kind of repetition and rhyming thing that has the way I was trying to organize the book, that's how it trails off.
I'm going to definitely edit this out, but what do you think happened to Raj?
What do you think happened to Raj? That's the question. I'm not answering that.
Two quick questions then. You were an actor in a film called Almost in Love.
That's right, yeah.
Do you plan to do more?
If I'm asked, yeah, I enjoy it. That was a friend, Sam Neve, the director, approached me and asked if I'd be part of his film. And it's a love story in two continuous shots. So it's an hour and a half movie with two 45-minute shots. And the way he did that was to mic us all up. And, you know, the camera follows different people through the action at two parties, basically. And he needed people who would be happy to improvise and happy to, you know, if you were given a kind of topic to talk about, who would kind of be able to talk around that. And, you know, at the center of it, there are people, you know, there are people with lines and big parts. And I pop up playing a kind of slightly cheesy version of myself in a white scarf.
Harry Kunzru, what are you working on now?
I have a really exciting project on at the moment, which is something that I don't think has been tried before. I was approached by the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, you know, which is a place known really for having a wonderful collection of old things, of old design objects and so on. But they do some contemporary stuff as well, and they wanted to explore the relationship between narrative and design. And so they are commissioning a story from me, which is about memory and about the idea of memory palaces, the art of memory and kind of pre-printing cultures. I'm writing a story involving that and the idea of memory and the idea of objects in space. And they're commissioning 20 designers to make work around this story. So actually a lot of which will be three-dimensional work. They're offering kind of graphic designers the chance to work in space rather than just on the page. So we're going to make a publication, but where there's also going to be an exhibition, a gallery, which will attempt to tell a story through the experience of walking through a gallery.
And another novel, have you begun thinking about it?
I have got another novel that I'm beginning to think about, a bit early to really describe it. But it's a science fiction novel. So, yeah, I'm coming back to my 13-year-old self, in a way.
You've been listening to an interview with Harry Kunzru, whose latest novel is Gods Without Men. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.